From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, taking the fight against privatizing mental health care straight to Lansing.
This is a fight that will happen for years until I think we come to recognize that the consumers are best served by a public safety net system.
How Spartan coach Duffy Doherty tackled racism in football, bringing young black players from the South to East Lansing, including NFL legend Gene Washington.
At that time in the 60s, there were a whole lot of things that were still going on down South.
Peeling back the layers of property speculation in Detroit.
Really, in the last 3 years, a lot of properties in our neighborhoods are being bought up, and we don't know who's doing it. Or when we look at the records, we can't figure out who it is.
Those stories and much more today for you on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. That first hour after birth is especially crucial to both the baby and the mama. How did we learn that? From kangaroos. We'll explore what's called the golden hour later in the show. But first, word has come from Washington. By year's end, new federal rules could bring overtime protection to more than 4 million American salaried workers, more than 100,000 here in Michigan. So let's look at these new federal overtime pay rules, what they'll mean for workers and for employers. We begin with Michigan State University economist Charlie Ballard. So, Charlie, how significant are these rules?
Well, they don't apply to most workers. You said the estimate is 4 million salaried workers nationally would be affected. The, you know, our total labor force is on the ballpark of 150 million. This does not apply to hourly workers. If you punch a time clock, you're already eligible for overtime. Right now, if you're salaried, you're only eligible for overtime if you make less than about $24,000. Under the new rule, you would be eligible for overtime if you make less than about $47,500 or so. And what that'll mean is, well, honestly, I think that there could be a whole lot of different responses from employers in different situations. In a lot of cases, the employer is going to go ahead and pay the additional overtime. In some cases, let's say that you've got a worker who's already making $42,000, $45,000. You may well just raise their pay to the new threshold, and that way you don't have to fuss with the overtime rules. Some employers might cut back the hours on some workers and hire some new low-wage workers to make up the slack. There's a lot of different things in play. I think on balance, there's a group of workers who are going to get more pay, but it's going to be very individual-specific, and I don't think there's one hard and fast one-size-fits-all rule that's going to tell us exactly how it's going to work out.
So I guess what the president was trying to address was the fact that while you see hourly workers who can have already gotten OT, perhaps because of union contracts or whatever, so many of these mid-level managers and mid-level salaried workers could wind up working a whole lot of overtime and get paid nothing.
That's right. And the number of the salaried workers who can work a lot of overtime and get paid nothing extra for it, that fraction has gone up dramatically. Back in 1975, most salaried workers were eligible for overtime. Now the estimate is that that only applies to 7% of salaried workers. So there has been an erosion over time in the ability to get overtime pay for this group of workers.
Do you expect this to go off without any court challenge?
No, but I do think that it is likely to go through. There have been some pushbacks, of course, by employer groups. One thing that I've heard in the conversations about this is that some employers say, yeah, we're okay with raising that threshold, but you're doubling the threshold overnight when this new rule comes into play in December. Some employers had pushed for phasing it in over time. But I do believe we're going to probably get what the Labor Department has said we're going to get.
Charlie Ballard, Michigan State University economist, as always, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Over now to Brian Crusher. He's an employment law specialist with the Royal Oak law firm Howard & Howard. Brian, there are several categories of employees who are going to be exempt from the new federal rules. Who are they and why?
Well, the exemptions will basically remain the same for what's been commonly referred to as the white-collar exemptions, and those would include executive employees, administrative employees, and professional employees. And the exemption will apply based upon certain primary duties as well as the salary threshold, which is the most significant change in the new rules, which will become effective December 1st.
So are we kind of saying that the folks who are exempt, like teachers and doctors or outside sales reps? Is it because it's just automatically assumed they'll be making over that threshold, or are there other reasons?
Well, I think that those who are making over that threshold is easy. They are going to continue to be exempt, assuming that they're properly classified now and meet the duties test. It's kind of that in-between group of folks, which the DOL has estimated at about 4.2 million employees in the U.S., who will have to be analyzed and looked at and decide whether they meet the duties test and continue to meet the duties test, and where they fall in terms of the salary threshold.
Brian, you mainly work with employers, helping them navigate labor laws and employment issues. So what are you going to be telling employers they should be doing to get ready for this change that's happening December 1st?
Well, first, they have a little bit of time here to react, which was not anticipated. There was some talk that the effective date would be 60 days from today, so there's a little bit of a breather between now and December 1st. But what I'm telling my clients and employers is that this is a good opportunity for them to go back and do a gut check and make sure that they're currently meeting the proper duties test, because those have not changed. So look at job descriptions, do audits to make sure that what their job descriptions say, your employees actually are performing, to make sure you fall within one of those exemptions that I just mentioned. Employers are also going to have to take a good hard look at their payroll numbers. You know, the effect of this particular change could take a variety of paths. Employers may increase salaries for some folks to get them and maintain them over this new threshold that's more than doubled from the threshold that was before December 1st. So maybe they'll increase the salaries of some folks. But on the other hand, employers may end up decreasing the salaries and looking to see a combination of now eligible employees for overtime plus a lower salary to keep them at basically the same wage they're earning now. They may have to look at their payroll figures and may decide that they're going to, hire two part-time employees instead of a full-time employee. So there's a variety of different ways this might shake out.
Do you foresee any court challenge, Brian?
There could be a court challenge to it, but, there's been a lot of administrative orders that have come down, including the National Labor Relations Board and some certain things going on there where the Affordable Care Act, so there's always court challenges, but I can't say whether I necessarily foresee one at this point or not. The fact that the duties test has not changed in this particular case, and we're looking at a salary threshold, the chances of a court challenge, we've got some time to see what happens there, but it's still a good wake-up call to employers, I think, to audit and analyze and make sure they're in compliance just with the duties test, and then they can see over the next 6 months whether there'll be a challenge to the salary threshold.
Brian Crozier is an employment law specialist with Howard & Howard, a firm in Royal Oak. Good to have you with us, Brian. Thanks so much.
Pleasure to be with you. Thanks.
To Lansing, the Michigan Chill will start their inaugural season in the WPSL, the women's premier soccer league. With us now, the head coach of the Michigan Chill, Jorge Hufresio. Welcome.
Thank you very much for having me here.
Now, the league already does have a team in Grand Rapids and one in Metro Detroit. Now, I know that the men's team, Lansing United, right, started in 2014, doing pretty good crowds those first couple of years, about 1,000 fans per game. What are your hopes or your expectations for your inaugural season in the capital city?
What I have seen is a very good support from the local clubs. There are a lot of kids playing in the area, and I believe that we're going to have a big crowd. We want to make sure that we provide a very high competitive level, fun environment for kids and family, and obviously to have role models for these girls. They might have aspirations to play at a high competitive level.
I'm speaking with Jorge Hufresio, who is the head coach of the Michigan Chill Soccer Club. It's going to begin its inaugural season in Lansing for the Women's Premier Soccer League. Most minor league soccer teams draw their players from local universities because, since yours is an amateur team, college players can play without losing their NCAA eligibility. Am I correct?
You are correct. Yes, you're right.
So you've got schools like you've got Michigan State, Michigan, you've got Western Michigan, a number of schools to choose from. But you yourself have a lot of international coaching experience. So I'm kind of wondering, can fans expect the Michigan Chill to be a mix of local and international flavor on the field?
Yes, that's one of our goals. It has been difficult because the fact that we cannot pay players, we still have a semi-pro team. So we had to make sure, we pick the right players. But yes, we're going to have some interesting players internationally coming to to the Lansing team. It will be a very good mix for, you know, and very good experience for both sides, for the internationals and for the local talent players to be playing together.
You know, Jorge, we've watched, you know, United States women as they win the World Cup last year. I'm wondering, do you think that's the boost that women's soccer in this country needs for teams just like yours, just like the Michigan Chill, to get fans into the stands, or as they like to say here, put butts in seats?
There is the interest, and U.S. has done amazing, you know, these World Cups and the last Olympic, and then even the previous World Cup when they didn't win it on 2011, mm-hmm. You know, they've been a very successful team. Like you say, it has to be, I think it needs to be a push on not just the girls, like the girls, you see girls playing everywhere, but it has to be a support from everyone. We cannot just be men supporting men or women supporting women. The game is soccer. So if we can everyone support everyone, this is the best scenario. Yes, U.S. has done amazing great. The kids coming up is a new culture that I believe in the future is going to be like, you know, there are going to be stadiums full. And we're going to even have more professional teams in the future. So the boost is coming, and I think we're on the right path.
Jorge Eufrasio is the head coach of the Chill SBC Soccer Club, bringing women's premier soccer league action to mid-Michigan, to Lansing, starting this summer. You can find out more at their website, chillsoccer.com. Jorge, great talking with you, and best of luck with the inaugural season.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It seems like Mother Nature does know best. Well, at least Mother Kangaroos. There's a growing trend in childbirth becoming ever more prevalent in Michigan hospitals. It's called kangaroo care, skin-to-skin bonding between newborn and mama. Dr. Kat McArdle is a senior resident in the Department of OBGYN at St. Joseph Mercy Hospital, Ann Arbor. I had never heard of this until our granddaughter, Rory, was born in February. We slipped in to meet her during that special hour of skin-to-skin time.
Congratulations on your new grandbaby. That's wonderful.
Thank you.
So we think that it came around in about the 1970s when they were having issues with premature babies, in particular in Colombia. And this doctor found that if he put the baby skin to skin, the babies did much better. Unfortunately for us, it takes a little while for things to come through sometimes. So it wasn't really till the 1990s that the WHO really found that it was beneficial and that we started bringing it into our mainstream NICUs and ICUs for babies around America and around the world.
So exactly what is it?
What it is that you put the baby, and this has usually been done with newborn infants who are premature, but now we do it with a lot more newborns in labor and delivery just as a routine. And you put the baby skin to skin with the mom, and we think up to a good hour after they're born, we call this now the golden hour. And we know that the babies do wonderful things. So for the babies get warmed up by the mom if they're too cold. They get cooled down by the mom if they're too hot. They regulate their glucose better. They regulate their bilirubin, which turns them yellow. They do that a little bit better. And they start breastfeeding earlier, and they keep breastfeeding for much longer. And, of course, we know there's so many benefits attached to breastfeeding now that all of this is just wonderful for the babies. What we now know is that we now think that it's good for the mums, too, which is why we started doing it on labor and delivery, so not just for premature babies.
And what does it do for moms?
So for moms, what we think is they get this huge burst of oxytocin, which is that feel-good hormone that everybody's heard of. But what, other than feeling great and feeling very much in love with your baby and starting that attachment process, we know that it stops the mum bleeding as much, so we have less hemorrhage, which is still a worldwide killer for women in labor. So that's great for them. And we know that their attachment bonding process just works so much better. Right up to about a year, we see mums who've had skin-to-skin straight after birth do things like touch their children more and caress their babies a little bit more and bring them to their pediatricians more often, which is fascinating, just thinking that you're going to put the mom and the baby together just after birth. It's really interesting.
Well, I think, Dr. McArdle, when I think of both of my children born via C-section, one in 1984 and my second in 1992, I know I didn't get to hold my son until I was well back into my room from recovery. And my daughter, I think I did get to hold her a little bit sooner, but nothing like skin to skin. Is this possible even with a C-section, say in an operating room?
Well, that's very interesting. And so what we've done at St. Joe's is that we're constantly looking for ways to be more family-centered. And we realized that we weren't doing it in the operating room, but that we took our lead from some units around in the U.S. and definitely more that I've seen in the U.K. And yes, it is really possible. And so we started this project to try and make it our standard of care in the operating room. And so what we do is straight away after the C-section, we take the baby to the warmer, give them a really good check over and make sure they're doing okay. And then we bring the baby and we put it and we tuck it right down on the mum's chest. And the anesthesiologist is there and the nurse is all there making sure that everybody's safe and well. And if at any point the mum's not happy or the baby's not happy, we can take them away. But we've gone from having no babies getting any skin-to-skin in the operating room to just after 1 month, 50% of our babies getting skin-to-skin in the operating room, and now over 60%, and we're going up and up. So we're looking forward to making this the new standard of care in our hospital and encouraging all of the hospitals around Michigan and the U.S. to do the same, because we think the benefits are just so wonderful for everybody.
What about dads and partners? Can they experience this as well?
Great question. Well, if the mum will let go of the baby, then it's definitely for the dad. So both in a normal delivery, if the mum's needs some stitches or anything like that, that's what my husband did. The nurse just popped the baby down the dad's T-shirt and my husband and son just sat there all snuggled up. And in the operating room, the same. So dads, partners, grandmas, if you're going to go into a labor and delivery and be a support person, I would recommend wearing a T-shirt with like a stretchy top so that if at any point you get your hands on that baby, you can just put it down there. Now, we don't know exactly if the benefits are exactly the same for dads and partners doing skin-to-skin with the babies, but I can't imagine that they're detrimental in any way. And if nothing else, it's certainly lovely for them to have that experience.
And are we getting a sense, Dr. McArdle, if this is spreading through most Michigan hospitals? Is it catching on?
Well, we definitely know that this golden hour is being taught in nursing schools and in medical schools. We know that after a normal delivery, a lot of places are doing skin-to-skin now, uninterrupted for about an hour. In the operating rooms, I can't speak to exactly how many units are doing it. I know that there are certainly a few units doing it around Michigan, and we hope that it will just increase as time goes on.
Dr. Kat McArdle is a senior resident in the OBGYN department at St. Joseph Mercy Hospital in Ann Arbor. And the thing to ask for is that golden hour skin to skin and just make like a mama kangaroo. Dr. McArdle, great talking with you. Thank you so very much.
You're more than welcome. Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. When you see a college football team run out onto the field, it is virtually impossible today to realize this fact. It was not that long ago that few, if any, of those young players would be African American. A powerful documentary from filmmaker Maya Washington tells us the story of when and how that changed. Through the Banks of the Red Cedar. It shows us the way Michigan State University coach Duffy Doherty confronted racism on the football field by bringing young black players from the South to East Lansing. One of those young players, wide receiver Gene Washington.
The civil rights movement was not just about marches and sit-ins and boycotts and protests. It was also about confronting segregation in different spaces. And the Michigan State teams of the 1960s, they confronted segregation on the field physically. They challenged the color line in numerous ways.
Gene Washington was a key part of the first fully integrated football team in America, a team that won national championships in 1965 and 66. He's in the College Football Hall of Fame. He's been honored as one of the 50 greatest Vikings for his pro career and so much more. Gene Washington is also Maya's father, and it is a pleasure to welcome both Maya Washington and Gene Washington to Stateside. Hello to both of you.
Hello.
Hello.
You know, Maya, we grew up kind of seeing our parents as just dad and mom without fully understanding or really seeing who they really are to the rest of the world. How did you come to the realization of just who Gene Washington and his teammates really are in sports history and then say, I want to make a film about it?
Well, it happened in 2011 when Bubba Smith passed away in August of 2011. And my dad and his teammates were gathered at Bubba's home the night before the memorial service, and I'm finally at an age, I guess, where I was able to sort of start to see my dad and these teammates differently. They're sitting around the pool telling old stories about Bubba, about each other. And something shifted in me to really start thinking about my dad as a college student. in the 60s. And so my dad said that it was Bubba Smith's father who recommended my dad for an opportunity to go to Michigan State. So just like you said, most of us, you know, we think of our parents as parents only. And I knew my dad came from the segregated South. I knew he went to Michigan State, but I had no understanding of how that took place. I sort of had this fantasy that these magical white men came down and found him and plucked him out of Jim Crow. And so in 2011 was the first time I got that important detail. And that just led me to want to learn more about it and especially find a means to thank Bubba Smith for the ways that that recommendation changed my dad's life and ultimately changed what was possible for my entire family. So that really was a catalyst that led me on this journey. And my dad was inducted into the College Football Hall of Fame later that fall. And so the more I was around this history and this content, I just knew I had to tell this story.
And Gene, you, along with teammates Bubba Smith and George Webster and Clinton Jones, you really became part of sports history by playing on that MSU team that won the 1965 and 66 national championships and then being first round picks in the 1967 NFL draft. When and how did you first meet Duffy Daugherty?
All of the schools in Texas were closed to black athletes. And so I got to know Duffy mainly because of Bubba Smith. And Bubba Smith's father was a football coach in Shorten Paulett, is the name of the high school at the time in Beaumont, Texas. So with that recommendation and to Duffy, his father recommended me very strongly. And I was a good friend of Bubba. We competed against each other, and he told me that, Gene, I'll put a good word into you with Duffy. And so I was recruited mainly through Bubba and his father. So that's how I got to Michigan State.
And I saw somewhere as I was looking through the website at throughthebanksoftheredcedar.com to learn more about this film you're putting together, the term the Underground Railroad of College Football. That was Michigan State University. What a stunning way to put it. You and these players, as Maya said, you came from the Jim Crow South, and boom, you are at East Lansing, you're at Michigan State University, this integrated environment. And you were so young. What are your major memories of those early days at Michigan State, Gene?
The number one memory was it was so different because, you know, coming from a segregated situation, you have no experience of working together in a class situation with white students, and you've never had a white teacher, if you will. And then all of a sudden you're in an integrated situation. And so that freshman year, it took a lot to get used to the teaching, the coaching, and everything. When you're going into a completely integrated situation.
Did Coach Daugherty take steps to help you and make sure that this great experiment of his was indeed going to succeed?
Well, yes, he really followed up. And I hear again, he followed up with all of our players. We had a lot of players from, he was the type of person, not only the black players, but the white players too. But since he personally had recruited me from the Texas area, he was very concerned, and I spent a lot of time with him explaining how things were going. So he checked on us, and of course all of the coaches was very much aware of the situation in terms of where we were coming from, because at that time in the 60s there were a whole lot of things that were still going on down south. And although we didn't have the instant media in terms of what's actually happening, but in the south at the time there was a lot of civil rights marches that was going on. So they spent a lot of time with us, not only the black players, but also all of them. It was a team situation, see.
Maya, how do you construct your film to show us the connection between those 1965 and 1966 national championship players and what that means to the young players who run out on the field today in 2016?
Well, I think what you'll see is this sort of mirror or echo between what happened in the 60s and what's happening today, especially at Michigan State. They're really on top in a really magical way that they haven't been in almost 50 years. The extent to which the leadership of Mark D'Antonio, as well as President Simon and Mark Hollis sort of working together, that was also at play in my dad's era with John Hanna, the president of the university, Duffy Doherty, and Biggie Munn, the athletic director. So there are all these really unique sort of serendipitous parallels between the past and the present. But I think for my generation, we've grown up seeing African Americans playing football. This is what we do.
Yeah.
You take for granted that, you know, if you see a great top football team in America in college or at the professional level, there's going to be a representation of African American players. There may also be representation of Pacific Islanders. But this really shifted with my dad's team and his incoming freshman class of 1963, because before that, you might have seen one or two black players here or there, even in the Big Ten. But after my dad's class, and specifically those 65 and 66 teams, this team actually reflected what we see today. It was much closer than any team had ever come to full integration and sort of the numbers that you see on the field today. So I think through our father-daughter story of us sort of coming together over this shared history that I unfortunately spent most of my life not knowing much about, becomes sort of like a millennial bridge between the past and the present. And it's only made even greater or illustrated even greater through the 2013-2014 season that we happened to have our cameras rolling when the Spartans went all the way, won the Big Ten championship, then the Rose Bowl. And my dad and his teammates had the opportunity to go back to the Rose Bowl almost 50 years after they had a two-point loss in 1966. So to see the Spartans claim that victory and in a way see my dad and his teammates sort of reclaim a victory that is sort of haunted them for years was pretty remarkable and really special.
How did this film change the relationship between the two of you or make it richer? I'm going to let Dad start with that one.
Yeah, I would say this, and from an education standpoint, the most important thing for me going to Michigan State was the education part. And through Duffy and Biggie Munn and President Hanna and the university, I worked very hard because the most important to me at the time was really to get my degree. And I was very fortunate. I completed my 4 years. I ran track. I also played football. And I was able to also come back and do my graduate work in the off season when I played with the Vikings. So I have a master's degree also. So that's the part that was most important for me because we did not have that opportunity in a segregated situation in the South in terms of just getting a degree from a major university. In regard to I have two other daughters, and I'm just so proud that they have all completed their education. I'm learning a lot as I'm going through this, too. You know, when you have a daughter and you play sports, you don't have a chance to spend a lot of time talking about sports at the time that I was in it. And so now all of this information, all of these great times that I had playing at Michigan State is kind of coming back, and it's great that I'm sharing this with her at this time.
And Maya, you get to really do something maybe a lot of adult children don't get to do, really put a love letter to your dad out there.
Absolutely. I think just in terms of hours spent together talking on the phone and doing interviews like this and spending time together, that's been probably one of the greatest gifts. But also, I grew up in the arts. I was a dancer, was sort of intimidated by my dad's athletic prowess, and all of this happened before I was born. So he was retired from football while I was growing up. It just wasn't part of my life. And so he didn't necessarily sit me down and say, I'm going to teach you everything there is to know about football. But I also didn't say, Dad, teach me everything there is to know about football. And so through this process, I've definitely learned a lot more about football. I've come to appreciate Michigan State and literally the state of Michigan in ways that maybe I had taken for granted growing up in Minnesota. So I feel like I hope this will have a great benefit for the entire state of Michigan, something that you have to be very proud of that went down on the banks of the Red Cedar, you know, 50 years ago. But I know for me, this really changed my life, this opportunity that my dad was given. And I just feel grateful to be in a position to hopefully document this history for future generations.
Well, you can find out more about the film, including checking out the trailer and getting on a mailing list to keep up with announcements about the film, by going to the website throughthebanksoftheredcedar.com. What's going to be a very powerful documentary from filmmaker Maya Washington about her father, Gene Washington, and his teammates at Michigan State University. It was wonderful to meet both of you.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you very much.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. There's a new backdrop for Mental Health Awareness Month, the debate over whether to privatize Michigan's $2.4 billion mental health system. The idea gained steam when it was included in Governor Snyder's fiscal 2017 budget proposal, which called for turning over state funding and management to Medicaid HMOs. The Michigan Association of Health Plans has been lobbying for the switch, while the Michigan Association of Community Mental Health Boards is digging in to fight it. Robert Sheehan is the CEO of the Michigan Association of Community Mental Health Boards. He's with us now from Lansing, where thousands of mental health advocates have gathered at the state capitol today for a rally. Since the governor's initial proposal and the ensuing backlash earlier this year, there's been a work group formed to explore this. Lieutenant Governor Callie is leading it. So what's happening with this? Is there any movement?
Yeah, the work group's made some good progress. It started, like all work groups should, with identifying what are the values and principles that are behind the effort, and then what are the goals we're trying to accomplish. We're now about to enter the phase of determining how should the system look, what are the best design efforts, what's working in its current structure, and what needs to be improved. I think there's a good faith effort by the 130 people who are part of the group.
So what kind of timetable are you looking at? Because at some point, this budget has to be done and delivered, knowing that the new fiscal year starts in September.
So what's happened is the appropriations chairs in the House and Senate both are aware of the work group. They put together language that they're moving through the House and Senate now that take sort of the best thinking of our work group and put it into place. What it looks like it'll be is the work group will continue throughout the fall with a report due to the House and Senate sometime in the winter, December or February, depending on which bill is signed. So at this point, the work group's pace is good. Initially, they thought they'd come up with language and some outcomes in May, and most of us thought that was unrealistic. So the December or February dates are much more realistic.
So I guess speaking on behalf of the of patients throughout Michigan who require mental health care and for their families and caregivers, do you believe we'll see this happening in Michigan? Will we see mental health funding privatized?
We don't think so. If policymakers and House and Senate members and the governor listens to the voice of the consumer, it won't happen. But I should tell you, there are moneyed interests, you know, of course, pushing for it to happen. So it's always a debate, almost always, right, between those who have the money and those who will be impacted by it.
And whose voice is louder, do you believe?
Well, that's a great question. We tend to believe that consumers and their families and people in the community's voices will be louder. But it's a political battle, and this is a fight that will happen for years until I think we come to recognize that the consumers are best served by a public safety net system. We've known that since 1964. It's only now being questioned, and I think we're hoping this question period ends and we can get back to doing the common good focus that we've always had.
Another point of the rally today is aimed at getting state lawmakers to support parity legislation. What is that, Bob? Why is this needed?
Parity is pretty essential. It means that mental health care should have no greater costs or restrictions in its access to patients than physical health care. So let me give you some examples. In most insurance, even the commercial insurance you and I might have from our employers, the mental health benefits are very limited. It's limited to some outpatient psychiatry, access to medications, some talk therapy, and inpatient care. It doesn't include all the innovative things that the public system provides, by the way. And that's a concern. So if you and I needed what's called case management or residential care or what's called drop-in services to help my recovery, you and I couldn't get that in most health insurance plans. And yet for physical health care, you can get a wide range of treatments for a wide range of conditions.
So I think people in Michigan need to realize that mental health doesn't get the same priority and the same insurance coverage as physical health in this state.
That's exactly right. And I think there's a sort of a rallying cry that we use that mental health needs are common, real, and treatable.
Are there states in the union where parity does exist and that it's working well?
New York and California lead the way. Minnesota's pretty good. But because the federal parity law passed several years ago, most of us thought that would do it, you know, that we'd be done, but it didn't. So states had to enact their own, because insurance is guided, as is Medicaid, state by state. So the states have to pass a parity law that has real teeth in it.
And is there any move afoot with any of Michigan's legislators to get this going?
There is. There's a group actually called Partners in Crisis, which was formed about 10 years ago, actually, to move parity, and that group is still moving. And we have a lot of friends in the House and Senate. But it's a hard sell for employers who think they're cash-strapped and they don't want to pay for increased health insurance. What Minnesota found, though, Minnesota did this early on, they found their overall health care costs dropped because when people get health needs met, their behavioral health needs are met, and their physical health needs go down. It's actually a net cost saving.
Bob, you've got about 3,000 advocates in Lansing today at the Capitol for the annual Walk a Mile in My Shoes rally. What is the message to state lawmakers and to Governor Snyder in today's rally?
It's a two-part message. One was our historic message, which is mental health care is needed, and we need to expand it so everyone has access to it. And the stigma around mental health needs to go away. And then the new message this year is retain the public nature of the system and ensure the public safety net exists and is strengthened.
Robert Sheehan, Michigan Association of Community Mental Health Boards CEO. We want to thank you so much for being with us today.
It's always great talking to you. Thank you.
One of Detroit's consistent stories has been that of speculators. Exactly how do we determine who is a speculator, and is land speculation helping or hurting Detroit? This is an important question. My next guest has figured out speculators own nearly 20% of all land parcels in Detroit. Joshua Akers is an assistant professor of social sciences at the University of Dearborn and University of Michigan Dearborn, and he's one of the creators of an interactive website. It's called propertypraxis.org. Joshua Akers, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
How do you define speculator for purposes of this interactive website you've developed?
One is if you're an individual that owns three or more properties but don't have a taxable address in the neighborhood, so you're not there. The second is if you hold a large number of properties, but they're in various conditions. You may have some that are active businesses. You may have some that are vacant lots. You have vacant and abandoned houses. But there's some differences there. And then the third category, in which you'll find some single owners in our list, if you're out of state or out of country and you have a property that's vacant and abandoned, you're on the list.
Vacant and abandoned versus family, say, living in a house?
Right.
Okay.
Right.
So now we got a kind of a sense of what we talk about with a speculator. Is land speculation in and of itself a bad thing, something destructive to a struggling city?
In a functioning market, land speculation may not be a bad thing. Economists would argue that speculation determines price. You have people willing to go out and take a risk and set a price, and then you begin to set a market where people will exchange. And that may hold if we just took property as a financial instrument.
Because you started with that clause, in a functioning market.
Right.
So when we look at Detroit,
there's one, it's not a functioning property market. But two, property itself isn't just a financial instrument. So you think about the home that you or I live in. It's about how we use it. And oftentimes it's chosen by the neighborhood that we can live in or the community that it's engaged in. When you're just purely speculating on the finances of it, it actually removes that property from the neighborhood itself.
How so? Well, because when you think that maybe a house has just been sitting there with no one taking any action or any responsibility, so it would just be deteriorating anyway. So let's say if somebody comes in and buys it for speculative purposes, at least something's being done with it.
Not necessarily, right?
Okay.
It may be held in the same state that it was in and allowed to deteriorate. There's all kinds of varieties of speculation. But if we just take a residential property and you think about somebody buying it in the case that you've given to me here, they're usually just making a bet that someone else is going to do something around them that increases the value. They're not investing in the property. They're not engaged in keeping it up. And it's not actively circulated for another family to take up as a residence.
So it's basically taking it and putting it up on the shelf.
Right. You could think about it as circulating in a financial realm as opposed to in the neighborhood.
So in Detroit, what effects have we seen from property speculation?
Part of where this project came from is work with community groups and activists in the neighborhood. So I've been working in Detroit for about 6 years. And one of the things that's come up really in the last 3 years is a lot of properties in our neighborhoods are being bought up and we don't know who's doing it. Or when we look at the records, we can't figure out who it is. Right? So you have a number of limited liability companies operating, which are, it's a shell company. If you're a business owner, it protects your assets. So if you were to get sued, it's only the things inside the business. But one of the other things it can do, if you're a property speculator and you don't want people to know who you are, is it hides who you are. Mm-hmm. So if you're a community group or an activist and you're concerned about your neighborhood, or you're just a neighbor that wants to buy a home for, you know, perhaps your sister or someone else, finding out who to contact and do something about it is nearly impossible.
Okay, like peeling away the layers of an onion.
Right. So what we tried to do is both reveal who those owners and members of the LLCs are, to give community groups and activists a new way to think about and frame their neighborhood. These are the people that live in your neighborhood as well. They may not actually physically live there, but they own a piece of it, and their actions are affecting.
So when you go, like I've got my laptop up now, so propertypraxis.org, and without even having to think, the most well-known name when you talk about Detroit property speculators has to be Maddie Maroon, who owns the Ambassador Bridge. So you type M-O-R-O-U-N, and oh my goodness, there are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, so how many?
599.
Oh, my word. So I click on that, and all of those things that have lit up, I see a map of the city. I see purple. I see red. I see blue. I see little lots. I see great big things. They're all his in one way or shape or form.
In his case, when you click on his name, you'll see red. So we have a category of speculators with over 500 properties. There's only 4 people in that category. They show as red. Maroon is one of those.
Okay.
Once you click on his name, those that are just lit up in red, if you scroll out in the map, are his properties.
Okay. Who are some of the other big names?
Melvin Washington. He's a developer in the city of Detroit. He's done a number of for-profit, low-income developments. But he also holds 799 properties in various conditions. And that's why he's there. Mm. And the activities of these two individuals are quite different. Like I was saying, there's a variety of speculation. Mm-hmm. So in the case of Melvin Washington, it seems to be that he's acquiring larger plots close together to eventually do a development that has not come to fruition yet or he doesn't have the financing for. In the case of Maroon, it's more about strategy and protecting his businesses. So you see a lot of properties around the Ambassador Bridge. He owns the bridge, but he also owns a number of trucking companies and logistics companies. You know, if you look near the bridge, there's the Detroit-Renzer Rail Tunnel. He owns a number of properties around there. There have been numerous proposals by the owners of that tunnel to put in a new tunnel, which takes double-stack rail cars, and to turn those old tunnels into trucking tunnels. If you add double-stack rail and add those trucking tunnels, you've affected that bridge business quite dramatically.
So he is not going to say yes to that.
Right. Or he puts himself in a position that
he's doing it.
He can coordinate how that might happen. You see a number of purchases around the site of the new bridge that's supposed to go in there. You see a number of purchases out by City Airport, which has been proposed as a larger logistics hub, kind of betting on possible future expansion of that airport.
I'm interested in if we have any sense of how many of these speculators are outside of Michigan, even outside of the United States. Are we seeing a lot of that type of speculation?
You see some. One of the more interesting findings in this research is there's a lot of work out there right now about foreign direct investment, which is overseas speculators buying condominiums, buying properties, driving markets up. You see a lot of that here in Ann Arbor currently going on. In the case of Detroit, about 7% of those properties identified as speculation track back to addresses out of state or out of country. It's a relatively small number.
There is a Irish consumer advocate. He's kind of a celebrity consumer advocate named Eddie Hobbs, and his firm, Brendan Investment Pan-European Property, bought up a number of properties in Detroit. And I dug up an editorial from the Irish Independent from 2014. It's from the 11th of March. Headline, Detroit's loss is Hobbs's gain. His name is Eddie Hobbs. And as it says, Eddie Hobbs seems to be doing okay from the decline of Detroit. And it talks about property that he invested in empty houses in Detroit. And the final line just kind of jumped out at me here. I'm quoting the Irish Independent. Nice to see that there are one or two Irish vulture funds engaged in a bit of bottom feeding as well as the U.S. variety. Is bottom feeding equal to speculators? Is it an equation? Does speculation have to, you know, equate to bottom feeding?
No, but it becomes more profitable when it is. Not all speculation is necessarily bottom feeding, like we were talking about in the case of Maroon. It's very strategic in that case. Or in Melvin Washington, he's looking to do development. But in the kind of categories that we've built out, are those people that are sitting between 100 and 500 properties, you see a lot more of that. People looking for cheap properties using the Wayne County tax foreclosure auction, using mortgage foreclosure sell-offs by HUD and other people to buy large quantities of property. And these are often being remarketed, in some cases as wholesale, right? So you have some Ed Azar is a great example. Edward Azar grew up in Southeast Michigan. He's in Palm Beach, Florida. His entire business model, he'll sell individual homes, but he buys a large number of homes and then tries to sell them wholesale to other people that want to be property speculators. You see UK and Irish investment funds buying properties in Detroit that go into an investment portfolio, like a real estate investment portfolio, then selling shares on a larger portfolio that may include houses from Detroit that are completely uninhabitable and may include some in Orlando that actually have rentals in them.
So while all of that shuffling is going on, right, and I'm living on a street with houses that are owned by these speculators that are just sitting and decaying, and I can't buy it if I want to, as you say, to move my sister in there. Yeah. The deepest impact on Detroit neighborhoods is that it can suck the life out of the neighborhoods.
Absolutely. What it looks to us like a slow decay of vacant and abandoned property or something that's static, these properties are actually moving quite quickly in financial markets around the world. Capital is changing hands all the time. Titles are changing hands all the time. And the friction from that, the outcome of that, are the conditions that we see in the city.
So when we say Detroit's decline, there's been so much focus on, well, the deindustrialization or people leaving, packing up and heading north of 8 Mile and moving out to the suburbs. Mm-hmm. True that those certainly are part of it, but we have to consider what's happening here.
Deindustrialization, globalization, huge processes that have great effects on Detroit. But if we look at Detroit in the last 20 or 30 years, it begs the question, what's happening? What is still going on? And part of the site and most of my research has been about making the argument that we need to focus on the production of decline. What are the activities that continue to produce the conditions that we see today? And speculation is one of those things.
So what do you hope people can take away from going to propertypraxis.org?
We could think of it in a number of different ways.
Yeah.
For those community groups and activists that I've worked with, I hope that they can see new pathways for action, ways to confront these conditions in their neighborhoods. From a policy perspective at the city level, hopefully they can see the scale. When we talk about ownership in the city, 20% is speculator. The city owns a massive amount of property, nearly 100,000 parcels now. That's 30%. The next largest category is basically 50% of individual owners. So we're talking about a huge category that needs some kind of action. And as we're spending tens of millions, if not over hundreds of millions of dollars on this idea of eliminating blight now, mm-hmm, I think the fundamental argument that we're trying to get across is that we need to focus upstream. This is an incredible cost that's borne by the public, and yet it's actively produced. We can see who is producing it. So that opens the possibility for taking action before it becomes a public responsibility.
Joshua Akers is an assistant professor of social sciences at the University of Michigan, Dearborn, one of the creators of this interactive website. You can go to propertypraxis.org. Again, that's propertypraxis.org. Thank you so much for being with us, Joshua.
Thank you very much.
Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Cass Adair, Mike Blank, Tony Brown, Ryan Grimes, Mercedes Mejia, Daniel Razel, Lindsay Scullin, Kate Summers, and Carl Williams. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thanks so much for listening.